Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And as promised, we continue with Open Forum. Any question about the Catholic faith is welcome. And you don't have to be Catholic to call. That number, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. And also, as promised, Jimmy Akin here with us in studio. Now, Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of the brand new book, Teaching with Authority. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, how you doing, Cy?
I am very well. I have the feeling you have some business you'd like to conduct, though.
Yeah. So on a recent show, you and I were talking about the uncanny valley, and it's not a kind of salad dressing.
There is a valley one, though.
It's what not a place in California, though. I'm tempted to write a story and set something there.
Yeah. The San Joaquin Valley, uncanny valley.
Maybe. Yeah. But it is a concept, and the basic idea is that as things get progressively closer to the human form, they get more attractive. So that's like why, for example, anthropomorphic animals, ones that are drawn to look more human, are cuter than just regular animals.
Yeah.
They got the big eyes. They got articulated limbs like ours, things like that.
Right.
So that's why Bugs Bunny doesn't look like a regular rabbit.
No, he does not indeed.
Yeah. And there comes a certain point, though, where things are starting to get very close to the human form. And all of a sudden, they become uncanny and their attractiveness drops off because they're almost human but not quite.
And that is creepy.
Yeah. And that's the uncanny valley. And so things that are in that zone include like dead bodies or pod people. You know, or zombies or things like that.
Or certain robots.
Certain robots, mannequins.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And so you and I were talking about this, and we got an email afterwards from a woman named Brenda, who teaches the ninth grade CCD class at St. Nicholas Catholic Church in Nicktown, Pennsylvania. I think that may
be
named
after
Nicholas Chamberlain.
But it's the Feast of St. Nicholas today, right?
Yeah. So. But St. Nicholas Catholic Church, so St. Nick's in Nicktown.
Nice.
And she writes, I'm a ninth grade CCD teacher. A couple of weeks ago, our class was cut short because of a fire drill. I decided to play the latest Kids Questions podcast for them. Jimmy was the guest, and he and Cy were doing their traditional witty banter as part of that, Jimmy discussed the uncanny valley. One of my students actually knew what that was, as he had previously stumbled upon it and looked into it further. He asked if he could draw a graph on the whiteboard, attached as a pic of his drawing, and she had a photo. I told the class I would share it with you, and maybe we would be mentioned on a future broadcast. So I thought I'd just give a shout out to the ninth grade CCD class at St. Nick's Catholic Church in Nicktown, PA, and especially to Alex, who is the student who knew about the Uncanny Valley and was able to draw a representation of it. And if you search online, I can't point you to Alex's picture, but if you search online for Uncanny Valley and look in the images, you'll find examples of the kind of graph of the rising curve as things get closer, and then it suddenly drops off, and they'll have like examples noted along the way.
Yeah, how cool. A budding Jimmy Akin there in Nicktown, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Again, 888-318-7884 is our number. We do witty banter. I didn't know.
Traditionally, we do.
You and I do.
Yeah, I'm not sure about after the reforms.
No, we don't do reformed witty banter. We do traditional witty banter.
Okay.
I'm going to try for some witty banter.
Okay.
I can't say it. I don't know why. Maybe I can't do it then. Witty
the tongue
banter.
Twitter.
Yeah, I'm going to let you know when I'm going for witty banter.
Okay.
Over the course of the next hour.
You're going to
turn
on a big flashing light or
something?
I'll be
like, that was supposed to be witty banter. What do you think?
Okay.
All right. I'll see how I do. See if I can do some witty banter with you.
Okay. It takes two
witty banter, by the way, is the younger sister of David Banter.
I think you just like saying witty banter.
All right. We better go to a call.
Yeah. You don't want David Banter to get mad.
Don't make him mad.
He really hulks up.
You wouldn't like him when he's mad. Dan in Barston, Missouri, listening on 89.1 FM. You are first up with Jimmy Akin today. Your question, Dan.
Well, my question is, we know in the Bible it talks about there is a rapture of the church. And the rapture of the church happens when Christ returns. And then we have after that the tribulation period of 7 years. And then there's people that live on the earth for 1,000 years after that. And my question is that when the people that are living on the earth, some get saved and some don't, but during that 1,000 years, they die. Well, they give birth to children also. So if, you know, what happens to these people that are on the earth? Are they raptured out again?
Okay.
Or is there a second rapture of the church? Or is what exactly happens? Because I can't find any reference in the Bible from, I've looked in about 100 commentaries from Matthew Henry all the way on, and can't seem to find anything.
Okay.
You know, any mention of, but there is a mention of the second in the book of Revelation, but it doesn't give any description of what happened.
Okay, so let me talk about this a little bit. The viewpoint that you're articulating is a view that's known as pre-tribulation premillennialism. And premillennialism is the idea that in our future, there's going to be a 1,000-year period, or at least 1,000 years, where Jesus returns from heaven and then reigns on earth, typically said to be reigning from Jerusalem, and that during this period, things are going to be really wonderful. There will be people who live to really long ages, and it won't quite be a perfect world, but it'll be a very good one. And so that would be the period in which you refer to these people being born after the second coming of Christ and so forth. The pre-tribulation part has to do more specifically with the rapture event that you mentioned. The idea, just for people who aren't aware of this, is that before this millennial future period, there will be a time of great trouble known as the tribulation, where the forces of evil under the headship of the Antichrist and the devil are going to do really bad stuff. And before that period, there's going to be an event known as the rapture, where Jesus descends partway into the sky and then catches up all of the believers in him, including people who have died and fallen asleep in the faith. They'll be raised from the dead. They'll be caught up too. And then Jesus is going to take them back to heaven for a period of 7 years or some period of time, some fairly short period of time, while the tribulation occurs. Then Jesus will return again, slay the Antichrist, and inaugurate that 1,000-year period. And at the end of the 1,000-year period, according to the book of Revelation, there will be another outbreaking of the forces of evil. And this time, Jesus will deal with them definitively. All of the forces of evil will be definitively defeated, and we'll have the general resurrection, and all of the dead will be raised. And we'll have the final judgment, and then he'll inaugurate the eternal order on the new heaven and the new earth. Now, according to people, Dan, who believe in the pre-tribulational, premillennial view, the standard understanding is that the people who were born during the millennium, if they die during the millennium, they'll be raised at the general resurrection of the dead. If they are not, if they have not died during the millennium, then they will be transformed at this same time, either the resurrection of the dead or the final or the last judgment. They will be transformed into the same glorious state that other saints have previously been transformed into, and that Jesus has been transformed into following his resurrection, and that this is part of what various verses in the Bible mean when they talk about us being transformed to be like Jesus in the twinkling of an eye. And for those who are born during this future millennial period and who remain alive at the end of it, the same thing will happen to them. They'll be transformed in a twinkling of an eye after the final defeat of the forces of evil. But most of the people who believe in this view don't hold that there's going to be another rapture after the millennium. At least you don't find it commonly referred to in their writings, which is why you haven't found references to it, Dan, because it's not commonly thought to occur. However, that's what people who believe in pre-tribulational premillennialism think. But they are not all Christians. In fact, most Christians, both historically and today, have a different view of things. They don't believe in pre-tribulational premillennialism. That view has really only been around for a little less than 200 years. It's a very recent view in church history, and it's not something that you would find the early church fathers talking about. It's not something you would find the medieval theologians talking about. It's not something you would find the Protestant reformers talking about. All of them had a different view about how our future is going to play out. The majority view, and this seems to be the majority view among Christians today, is that actually the millennium is happening right now. In the book of Revelation, it talks about how the devil during the millennium is bound in such a way that he can't deceive the nations anymore. So he's not able to stop the gospel from spreading. And thus, the world comes to be filled with the knowledge of the Lord the way the ancient prophets in the Old Testament said it would. This is something, for example, that Isaiah talks about, that the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord like the waters cover the seas. And if you compare our state today, where a third of mankind is Christian and half of mankind believes in the God of Abraham, and almost all of mankind has at least heard of the God of Abraham, it does indeed seem that knowledge of the Lord covers the earth like the waters cover the sea, in comparison to the way things were in the prophet Isaiah's day, when only a tiny handful of people believed in the God of Abraham and knowledge of God was very, very restricted. And so there's a very good case just based on that, and there are many other factors as well, but based on that, that indeed we're living in the millennial period right now, that it was inaugurated either at or shortly after Jesus's ministry on earth, and that the devil is bound in such a way that he can't deceive the nations, and so the gospel has been spreading for the last 2,000 years. Now, there are other factors that also play into this. A lot of scholars will look at the book of Revelation and say, it's kind of a mistake to assume that this is all about our future. Some of it is. Some of the stuff at the very end about the resurrection of the dead, that is about our future. But it looks like a lot of it actually is about the turmoil, the tribulation that occurred at the beginning of church history, either leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD that Jesus had prophesied, or at least in the age of persecutions that the early Christians experienced before Christianity became a tolerated religion. So I can't go into a whole lot of that right now, for reasons of space on live radio. But we have material at Catholic.com. If you go to Catholic.com and type in Revelation or Rapture, you'll come across information like that. One passage I did want to comment on is found in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. This is the classic passage that people point to in connection with this rapture event. Now, I should note the term rapture is not found in Scripture. That's a theological term that is used in some communities. Catholics don't tend to use it a lot, but there's nothing in principle wrong with it because 1 Thessalonians does describe that an event where the believers are caught up to be with Jesus. And the description of that is found in 1 Thessalonians 4. Starting with verse 15, St. Paul says, "According to the Lord's word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord," so this is the second coming, "will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. After that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we will be with the Lord forever. Therefore, encourage one another with these words." Now, in the pre-tribulational theory, The idea is that we go up to meet Jesus in the clouds, just like St. Paul says, and then Jesus goes back to heaven for a period of time. But that's not what this passage says.
No.
It would indicate that that there would then be like a third coming of Jesus afterwards, where he really comes back down to earth. Here he just kind of dips down into the sky and goes back. But Paul doesn't say anything here about him going back. And if you check out a broad range of commentaries, scholars will point out that actually this passage reflects a custom that was very common in the first century when a dignitary, such as a returning general or a king or someone very important, was visiting a town while he was still on the road. As a sign of respect, the population would go out to meet him outside of the city.
We
even see that in the book of Acts, where St. Paul is on his way to Rome, and St. Paul, being a dignitary in the Christian community, is met by a delegation of fellow Christians who have come from Rome, and they come out as far as several towns away to meet him and then escort him back to Rome. And this was a typical thing you would do for an important visiting dignitary. And so scholars have said that's the real background here. When Jesus descends, the idea is he is the Son of God, he is our King, he's returning, and so we end up meeting him in the air to then escort him back down to earth for his perpetual reign. And so actually this is an event that occurs at the very end when he returns to raise all of the dead and have the general judgment and inaugurate the eternal order. So that's something I know it's kind of coming from a different point of view, Dan, than what you are familiar with. But that's the way an awful lot of scholars look at this. And I would encourage you to think about that further and do some reading at Catholic.com.
Dan, thank you very, very much for that call. We appreciate it. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. So if you've got a question, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Don't forget that right now we have a free ebook for you on our Facebook page. You just go to Facebook, put in Catholic Answers. You'll see the one with the little blue shield next to it. That's us. And when you get to our Catholic Answers Facebook page, scroll until you find the book entitled The Holy Family, An Advent Companion, and you can have it for free.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Catherine Zeltner.
There are so many misconceptions when it comes to abortion and assisted suicide. It's really confusing, and I think for a lot of people, they don't know how to talk about these things. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, we help to change that. We help to really untangle these web of lies. Listeners can expect to become informed and then grow more confident so that they can then discuss and dialogue these issues, and together we can really impact culture in that way.
EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, and any question is welcome on the Catholic faith, or if you have a question of a more broadly religious nature, or maybe a philosophical question, those are welcome as well. It's open forum. Anybody can call. You just bring the question. 888-318-7884 is that number. Let us go then to Joseph in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening on 102.7 Spirit Catholic Radio. Joseph, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, gentlemen. My question is about Matthew chapter 5, verse 25 and 26.
Mm-hmm.
I never hear it argued about purgatory, like using that scripture.
Mm.
And you don't get out of hell, that prison sentence you don't get away mm-hmm. from. So I was wondering if God is referring to purgatory right there.
Okay, so this passage is found in the Sermon on the Mount. And in this passage, Jesus says, "Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny." So the literal sense of this, just based on what Jesus says, it's not clear that he's telling a parable at this point. And in fact, if you look in context, we don't have a lot of parabolic language here in the Sermon on the Mount. You back up a couple of verses, for example, and he says, "Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. Go first and be reconciled with him, then come and offer your gift." So in Jesus's day, during his ministry, the altar in Jerusalem was the place that Jews would go to offer sacrifices to God. And this, incidentally, is a good indication that Matthew's gospel was written before the destruction of the temple in AD 70, because when this was still relevant to Jews. If they wanted to go offer something to God at the temple and they realized, my brother is offended at something I've done, well, let's go reconcile with him and then come back and give my offering. So doesn't seem to be a parable. And if it's true, since it's not a parable, it just seems to be a principle that Jesus expects us to apply. And the same thing is true in the following verses, where Jesus says, "Settle matters quickly with your adversary who's taking you to court." Courts were real things. You had adversaries that obviously you weren't reconciled with, and so it's definitely a good piece of advice to settle out of court, to be reconciled, because otherwise you could get thrown in debtor's prison and you're not going to get out until you've paid the last penny of whatever your brother has against you. And so, and that once you're in debtor's prison and not making any income, it's even harder to get out because you're not making the money you're going to need to pay the guy back. And so just looking at the passage, it's not clear to me that it automatically should be taken as a parable, but just in both of these cases, just as principles that we need to follow in our lives regarding being reconciled with other people. Now, having said that, is it possible that we can draw a broader spiritual lesson out of this and treat it kind of as a parable? Yeah, I think we can. And certainly people have, and in fact, in the past, I myself have even pointed to this as something in support of purgatory. The idea would be that, if you're not reconciled with your brother here on earth and you end up standing before God the judge, God may say, okay, you've got some consequences to deal with as a result of, the state of affairs between you and your brother and what happened between the two of you on earth. So now you need to be purified of those consequences, and you won't be released until they're all taken care of. So you're going to have to spend some time in purgatory. It is possible to make that application, but I think there are stronger passages to use in favor of purgatory, like 1 Corinthians 3. And so because it's not clear that Jesus is necessarily using a parable here, because a person who doesn't believe in purgatory could look at this passage and say, well, I don't think that's what Jesus is saying here. I would rather look at passages like 1 Corinthians 3 that are more clearly about something happening in the afterlife that purges us, rather than a passage like this. And so in recent years, I really haven't used this passage in defense of purgatory because it can be taken plausibly in other ways. And I'd rather spend my time on passages that can't so easily be taken in other ways.
Joseph, thank you for that call. I hope that was a helpful answer. We'll leave it there and move, because we got a lot of people to get to today. Andrew in Little Rock, Arkansas, watching on YouTube Live, is next. Andrew, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Jimmy. Hello, Cy.
Hi.
Howdy.
My question to you is about 1 Corinthians 3:12.
Well, what do you know?
Dialoguing with.
There's a theme developing here.
I'm dialoguing with someone, and he said that this verse is in support of like a judgment for Christians, mm-hmm. and then there's another judgment for non-Christians. So I was just wondering where he could have gotten this from, because I always understood this to be basically in the defense of purgatory and the Catholic understanding of purgatory.
Okay, and there's the music, so we'll have to wait till. Can you wait through the break, Andrew?
Sure.
No All right, problem. We'll get the answer on the other side. I need a break. I got to work on my witty banter. I just feel like I'm really letting you down with the witty banter.
Oh, no. No, it's okay.
It's all right?
Yeah.
Okay, more to come. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Advent is upon us and Christmas approaches. Catholic Answers wants you to know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter the promo code CALIVE18 at checkout. With great new products on doctrine, church history, morality, apologetics, and much more, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to shop.catholic.com today to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the internet going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout and save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
With the recent commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the release of Humani Vitae, there have been fresh attacks on Catholic teaching from outside and, unfortunately, inside the Church. That's why Catholic Answers thought it critical to provide a vigorous affirmation of Pope Paul VI's prophetic wisdom with our newest book, Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humani Vitae. We asked five distinguished contributors to reflect on and defend Humani Vitae from five perspectives, each of them compelling, together forming a mosaic of truth. Don't be caught uninformed when the topic comes up among friends, family, and coworkers. Order your copy of Inseparable today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or by visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Tomorrow on More to Life, the life you were meant to live.
We'll look at how the theology of the body can help you live a more abundant life. That's tomorrow on More to Life, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 Central on EWTN Radio. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, Andrew in Little Rock on the phone, and we had to interrupt Andrew for a break. Yeah, Andrew, did you last through the break?
I'm still here.
All right. So, Jimmy, the question...
The question, in essence, was Andrew had encountered someone talking about different judgments for people who are saved versus who are not saved, and relating 1 Corinthians 3 to a judgment for the saved. And Andrew had previously understood this verse in connection with purgatory, and so we wanted to know how all that fits together. Well, there are individuals, particularly in the Protestant community, who think that there will be notably different judgments. And for example, now I should say, actually, in the Catholic Church, we agree there's more than one judgment. There's what's called the particular judgment that occurs at the end of your life when you die and you encounter the Lord and are judged, and you may end up going to hell there, or directly to heaven, or you might be assigned to purgatory to be cleaned up in preparation for going to heaven. But there is a kind of judgment that occurs to your soul when you die. And then at the second coming, when the dead are raised, there will be another judgment known as the general judgment, in contrast to the particular judgment, where you've now been reunited with your body and everybody's going to be judged. And your fate won't change, You're either destined to go to heaven or hell based on what you did in your life on earth. Now you're being judged publicly because nobody sees your private judgment, at least not here on earth. Mm-hmm. And also now you're being judged in body as well as in soul. So there are these different judgments. In the Protestant community, sometimes, especially among people who are premillennialists, like I mentioned earlier, there will be a further fragmenting of the judgments so that, for example, you'll find some people who will say, well, Revelation speaks of a judgment before God's throne, and this is called the Great White Throne Judgment. And some people will say, you're only going to be at the Great White Throne Judgment if you're damned. And so you're not going to even be there. You'll have already been judged in another way if you're in the Lamb's Book of Life that Revelation talks about. So that may be part of what your friend is thinking of, Andrew. I can't be entirely sure without knowing more about what he said and what his background is. But let's look at 1 Corinthians 3. So your friend would be right that this is a judgment that pertains to the saved. Now, I might say it doesn't necessarily pertain only to the saved, but at least the people Paul is talking about are saved. Doesn't mean there's no one else at this judgment. Just means they are saved, the ones he's talking about. So in this passage, I'll back up a verse. He says in 1 Corinthians 3:11, no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Christ Jesus. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, each man's work will become manifest, for the day — we're going to come back to that term — the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work which any man has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. So that's category number one of people, the people who have their work survive and they receive a reward. So they're clearly saved.
Okay.
He then says, if any man's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. So this is category two, people whose work is burned up. So they are saved. They're still among the saved, but they're not going to get the kind of reward that they had been hoping for. And so Paul names two categories of people being at this judgment. Both categories of people are saved. He doesn't mention one way or another, is there a third category of people who are damned?
Yeah,
he
doesn't
come into this. Could be, could not be. He doesn't tell us one way or another. Yeah. So that's an open question. Having said that, we might be able to use other passages in Scripture to fill that in, but we don't really need to for our present purposes. We can leave that question open. The key question is, when is the day that Paul is talking about?
Oh.
Now, ordinarily, just based on you know, the way the New Testament talks about the future and the day of the Lord and the day of judgment and things like that, one would assume that Paul is talking about the last day and the final judgment. And that would be a reasonable interpretation here. But there's a twist, because Paul is writing from a perspective where it hasn't yet been made clear that the world's going to go on for a long time. In fact, he expects that, and we can tell this from various passages in his writings, he expects that the second coming is going to happen when he's still alive. And that's why in other passages, for example, he'll say things like, we who are alive and remain.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that from 1 Thessalonians 4?
Right.
Yeah. So he's putting himself in the category of the people who remain alive at the second coming. So given that, Paul is expecting, he's not asserting this is going to happen, but the way he's imagining what's going to happen is, well, I and other people I'm writing to are still going to be alive on the last day when the second coming occurs, and we'll all be judged, and then Jesus will judge us, and these will be the results for Christians. But not everybody survives to the last day. And as it became clear with the course of history and also with the book of Revelation and John's realization through prophecy that there was going to be at least a 1,000-year period before the end of the world, it became clear that that first generation of Christians was not going to survive. So how would that affect the principle that Paul is articulating? Is it going to be true that you're not going to be tested and your works are not going to be tested until the very last day? Well, it wouldn't seem to be the case because Jesus has already told us in Luke's gospel, in the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, that people would be assigned either to a state of comfort or to a state of suffering earlier than that, because Lazarus goes to a state of comfort, the rich man goes to a state of suffering. And so it looks like people aren't having to wait until the last day to be judged. There is thus also what Catholics call the particular judgment at the end of our lives, when we individually stand before the Lord and are judged. And so it seems that the principle Paul is talking about applies to either one of these categories. If you're alive at the time of the second coming, then this principle applies to you on the last day. Mm-hmm. But if you die before then the day of your death is going to be the day that this principle is applied to you. And since Paul indicates that there can be and are people whose work has not measured up and it's going to be burned up and they're not going to receive their kind of reward, it does indicate that that's not going to be fun. You know, he compares it to escaping through flames. The image note is you've built a building.
Yeah.
And now your building is burning up and you're running out of it while your home that you thought you've made is on fire.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be fun to experience that. And so Paul does speak of a kind of event after death where even the saved are going to go through a kind of painful experience as part of their transition into heaven, and that's what we refer to as purgatory. So I think you can use 1 Corinthians 3 in connection with purgatory, and we don't need to argue, Andrew, over the question of is this a judgment just of the saved? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. Paul doesn't tell us, are there also damned people here? He does address these two categories of saved people, and one of them, he notes, does have this somewhat bumpy transition into heaven.
Andrew, thank you so much for that question. A lot of questions involving our end, and including our personal end and the collective end.
Let's get to as many as we can before the end of the show.
Okay. There's a little witty banter.
Very little.
Okay. Well, but at least we're, you know,
making the effort.
You're ahead of me, Jimmy. Let's just put it that way, okay? You're ahead of me now.
No.
Hey, Jimmy, you're one of the people who wrote one of the brand new Catholic Answers 20
I
Answers
did.
Books. You wrote the one on the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, okay, so let's say, why do some Old Testament laws seem harsh? Okay, that's one of your questions in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then you take about how many pages? Three and a half pages.
Yeah.
And that's generally what you'll get in these 20 answers books.
Typically, each answer is about 800 words long.
About 800 words long, and you get 20 of them in each of these. There are actually three new books out. In addition to Jimmy's book on the Old Testament, 20 Questions on the Old Testament, Jim Blackburn did 20 Questions on the Early Church, and Todd Agliolaro, the publisher, the director of Catholic Answers Publishing, wrote 20 Answers on Marriage and Sex. And right now, you get them all free when you order the Catholic – all of those three. You get four free when you order the Catholic Answers 20 Answers sampler. You just go to shop.catholic.com and order that sampler before Sunday midnight, and you get these three books thrown in with that sampler in addition to your order. Shop.catholic.com. Get your 20 Answers sampler today.
Call us now with your question on Catholic Answers Live.
Why do we need Catholic radio? Because not everybody's sitting in front of a computer or watching their television set at home. How about when driving to work? Catholic radio's there for you. I may be a Catholic priest, but I'm still a student of the faith. And Catholic radio helps supply good material, whether it be a question and answer format show, whether it be a show itself on doctrine or theology. I myself, as a priest, am always learning.
Father Wade thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
What's that?
All the guys in the engineering booth are playing air drums.
I was trying to keep up with Nick playing air drums, too, because I can't keep up with Nick. Nick's a professional drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And I,
that's true.
And yeah, he is.
He's even featured drumming in the Groovy Music from Thursdays.
Oh, that's right. The Thursday Groovy Music that we that no longer
haven't
plays.
Played, yeah.
No, because that's from Nick Check in the Dead Century. Nick drummed for them on their – was that their first? Mm,
certainly not dead music. It's very lively.
No, very lively. And then Andrew, of course, running the video today because Brandon's not here. We get the big man, Andrew, the father of Magdalena?
Magdalene.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Sorry. How old is Magdalene now, Andrew? We have so many babies around here. She's almost 4 months.
Boy.
God bless her. That's great. So first Christmas.
Getting up to her four-month anniversary.
Yeah. And I know what she's getting for Christmas. She's getting a bunch of comic books from the MCU
knowing
and DC
Andrew,
comic
that
books.
That would be right. Yeah. Get her started early.
I'll read them for you, little baby. Don't worry. I'll read them for you.
To you.
They'll still be here when you grow up. Let us go then to
and
Patrick.
Then Deathstroke broke into Arkham Asylum.
Oh, you got – is that one of your comic books or is that a video or what's that, Andrew? Oh, Batman
villain.
Yeah.
And he is in Arkham Asylum in the latest issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am so glad we got a little Batman in there, got a little Magdalene in there, little tiny little Magdalene. Patrick in New Orleans listening on 690 AM WQNO. So happy to have you with us, Patrick. I think we kept you waiting. I apologize for that, but your question for Jimmy.
No problem. Thanks for taking my call. My question is a little more prosaic than the others that we've heard tonight.
That's okay.
I just want to know whether the church has certified any non-medical miracles in connection with the canonization of any modern saints or any saints. We hear about, medical miracles, but I've never heard about a canonization a miracle being certified for the canonization that didn't have to do with someone's healing.
Right. And so the answer is yes. The church has used non-medical miracles in connection with the canonization of saints in the past. So the Congregation for the Causes of Saints has certified them on occasion, but it hasn't tended to do so recently. There's a fascinating book on miracles that was written by a Canadian doctor who herself is an atheist, or at least was. I'm not sure if she still is, consulted for the Vatican on a medical miracle. She didn't know what she was being asked to evaluate. She was a pathologist specializing in, if I recall correctly, like leukemia, blood disorders, things like that. And she was given some medical samples before and after and asked what her opinion of them was. Was there any medical explanation for what she would see in these samples? And she thought it was for a court case.
Mm-hmm.
She thought someone was being sued for medical malpractice or something.
Yeah.
And she looked at him and said, no, there's no medical explanation for this. Then she finds out, my client was the Vatican.
How interesting.
And they were asking me to evaluate a medical miracle. And she found it fascinating that they would ask her to do it. They never asked her to comment on the theology one way or another because that's not her area of expertise. They just asked her to comment on the medical side of things. They did not care that she was an atheist. They just wanted her medical opinion, and she gave it to them. But she then became fascinated by the whole subject, and so she ended up going over to Rome for the canonization,
mm-hmm.
and she wrote a book where she catalogs different kinds of miracles that have been used in canonization and did a statistical count over the last few centuries of different categories of miracles. And some of them were non-medical in nature, but most of them are medical, and especially in recent times, that tends to be the case. And I think there are a few reasons for that. One of them is that God doesn't do miracles just to satisfy our curiosity. I mean, God could do a miracle with any part of nature he wanted. You could, for example, pray, "Oh God, if you exist, please let there be a daytime visible supernova with, you know, tomorrow." And I would love it if God did that, because I would love to see a daytime supernova in my life, like the one that gave birth to the Crab Nebula a few hundred years ago.
Boy, I remember it well.
Yeah,
Jimmy.
You could see that in the day, and I would love to see something like that. But that's just – it's not a real need of mine to see something like that. And God doesn't do miracles just to satisfy our curiosity. When we see Jesus doing miracles in the Gospels, thus, he tends to be doing miracles that are really going to help people, like healings or exorcisms. Well, looking at those two categories, which are by far the most common kinds of miracles that Jesus does, looking at those two categories, it would be kind of hard to show that there's no scientific explanation for an exorcism in most cases, because in the case of an exorcism, science has not developed diagnostic criteria that scientifically will tell you, are you dealing with a demon?
Yeah, right.
And in fact, if the demon knows you're trying to establish his existence for purposes of glorifying God through the canonization of a saint, he's likely to not cooperate with the verification and, like, say, go silent.
Yeah.
Or something.
Right. You think maybe?
Yeah.
They are tricky.
That's what I do if I was a demon.
That's their main job.
Yeah.
Be tricky.
So that leaves us with medical things. There are things that genuinely do help people, and modern science has developed diagnostic criteria to verify the existence of a condition and to talk about its normal course, its prognosis. And if we then see something very dramatic happen where, the disease vanishes and there's no medical explanation for that, that's not part of the normal progression of the disease, even under treatment, then that makes it more easily documentable than other kinds of miracles that could occur or that God is likely to do. So I think there is a good reason why we tend to have canonizations mostly dealing with medical miracles rather than other kinds, because those are the kinds that God is most interested in doing for people, because they genuinely help them. They help address basic human needs, and also because they're easily or more easily verifiable.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, Patrick, thank you very, very much for that question. You could see that supernova during the day?
Yeah, you could.
And what did people say it looked like? Like just a bright light in the sky in addition to the sun? Or?
Yeah, but also I believe it had like a scattering pattern. Like if you look at the Crab Nebula now, you know, it's got the kind of splotchy thing going.
Oh, so
would have been smaller then because it hadn't had all that time to spread.
But it was a splotchy thing in the sky.
I think so, yeah.
Wow.
Like daytime comets, only cooler.
Yeah, way cooler. Although a daytime comet's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I never seen any of these things. I did see a partial eclipse. I've never seen the full eclipse.
Really?
But
well, don't look at it directly.
No,
that would hurt your eyes.
Yes. I have learned that lesson. Michael in Massachusetts, listening on Emmanuel Radio. You are up next, Michael. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, sir. My question is, and I'll take it off the air, the answer off the air, it's just what is the Catholic perspective on Ayn Rand's writings and her sort of philosophy of objectivism?
Okay. Well, the Catholic Church doesn't have an official statement on Ayn Rand or her writings or her philosophy. It's really up to individual Catholic thinkers to apply Catholic principles to those. This is something that's normal. The Catholic Church doesn't normally have a position on individual literary figures like Ayn Rand or an official evaluation of a particular school of thought. So basically, it's up to every individual Catholic thinker to apply basic principles to her thought and see what to make of it. If I were to do that, and I have a background in philosophy and also in Catholic theology, I would say that like other philosophies, like almost every philosophy, there are some valid elements in Ayn Rand's philosophy. In order for any philosophy to become popular, it's bound to have some elements of truth. And one of the things that's highlighted in Ayn Rand's philosophy is the value of self-interest. And that's something that is actually important in Catholic thought. Jesus himself uses enlightened self-interest as a motivator. He says, for example, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses his own soul?
Yes.
You know, it's not going to profit you to do that. And so that's an appeal to rational self-interest. And so rational self-interest is something that that Catholic principles find value in. And so to that extent, Ayn Rand's philosophy contains a positive element. Having said that, Ayn Rand tends to talk about self-interest in a way that makes self-interest more of an exclusive value. And here's where we're going to come to a bit of a parting of the ways between Ayn Rand's thought and Catholic thought. Ayn Rand doesn't really, my understanding is, she doesn't see anything other than self-interest, you know, rational self-interest, as a basis for altruism. She wouldn't say that you should love your neighbor and do good things for your neighbor that are not going to benefit you in any way.
Oh, yeah.
Just because it's good. She's not going to say that's a good that needs to be pursued. If it is going to benefit you, then absolutely do good things for your neighbor. But you don't have any obligation to do good if it's not going to benefit you, at least indirectly. And that's something that is a principle that Catholic thought would disagree with, because Jesus makes it very clear that love of God and love of neighbor, including disinterested love, love that is not based simply on self-interest, is something that is very important. This is one of the themes in the Sermon on the Mount, where he points out that God sends his rain on the just and the unjust. Now, to us, rain is not always a fun thing. You know,
yeah,
like
right.
We even have sayings like into every life, some rain must fall. And it gets pictured as a bad thing. But if you're living in an agrarian society where your food source is dependent on rain.
Yes.
Rain is a very good thing.
Yeah.
And so what Jesus means is God gives his gifts both to the righteous and the wicked. He loves everybody, even those who are ungrateful to him and are not going to help him. And he says in the Sermon on the Mount that we should be like our Father in heaven. We should love even our enemies, even when they're not going to benefit us in some way. And so that would be a point at which a Catholic would look at Ayn Rand's philosophy and say, well, this is a problem. This is something we don't go along with. Because while she's bang on in terms of rational self-interest and its value, we also need to be loving in a disinterested way towards God and towards our neighbor. And in fact, those are the two great commandments. So they're at the core of the Christian ethical system. So there's more that could be said about all that, but that's a basic sketch of kind of a first pass of what I'd have to say about Ayn Rand's philosophy.
You seem like you kind of shrugged when he asked the question.
Well, I didn't shrug. I mean, Atlas shrugged.
I wondered if you would get it.
Oh, Cy Kelly, you're such a
fountainhead.
You beat me to it. I was going to say you're such a fountainhead of information.
See, now there is some witty banter.
Well, I'll be singing the anthem of your praise for some time.
Jimmy Akin, you're all right. Michael, thanks very much for that question. I don't remember having received an Ayn Rand question before. Jimmy's brand new book is among the three. He's got two brand new books. One of them.
Mm-hmm. Teaching with authority. That's the big one.
That's the big one. And he's got the smaller one because it's a 20 answers book, the Old Testament. All three of those, the new books.
All two of those.
Well, I was going to say all three of the new books that are out from the 20 answers series.
Yeah. Okay.
The Old Testament, the Early Church, and Marriage and Sex are available right now on shop.catholic.com, as is Teaching with Authority. Jimmy, what's the next book? I forgot.
Can We Trust the New Testament?
Oh, I'm so glad you're doing that book. Can I do a spoiler?
Okay.
Yes, we can trust the New Testament.
Indeed, we can.
Join us tomorrow. We got two very good hours tomorrow. The second hour will be Layla Miller. The first hour will be Chris Bloom. Oh, what, that is a good day. Wow, I wish I could fast forward 22 hours and just be there now.
Try suspended animation.
I could try suspended animation. All right, I'm going to go outside and freeze myself. See you tomorrow for Chris Bloom and Layla Miller on Catholic Answers Live.